goal today is to start looking at the digestive tract, and we're going to begin in the mouth and work our way through the digestive tract all the way to the end. And in laboratory this week, tomorrow and Friday, you'll be examining the digestive tract, beginning at the esophagus, and working your way through. During the break today, I have a handout in front you can pick up, which is a drawing of the layers of the gut wall, beginning at the esophagus here on the left and going all the way to the colon on the right. And you can use these drawings to substitute for your own drawings. You don't have to make drawings. But you do need to label. You need to label these drawings and turn them in with your lab guide at the time of the final exam. So don't lose it. It goes in your lab guide. Just turn in with the lab final with your laboratory guidebook where you made your other drawings. So please don't lose that drawing, and your task is to use it as a guide to study esophagus, stomach, small intestine, colon, and to label it and to turn it in with your other drawings at the time of the final lab final. Questions about that? Some of you may not have finished tooth and salivary glands yet, but that's okay. There'll be plenty of time, I think. We're not ready to start on the oral cavity either, because we've got some slides left for the lungs. This is somewhere around slide 26 or 29. But before we left off yesterday we concentrated on the histology of the airway, beginning at the trachea and working down. And today we're going to continue with the bronchioles up in here, and then lastly talk about those part of the airway that actually engage in gas exchange. So we call that the respiratory portion. Up here, you remember, we call that the conducting airway. Most of our attention in the first hour then will be right here, and then the second hour we'll work on digestive tract. There are three digestive tract outlines in the documents on MyBU. The one that says digestive part one is the one that we're going to start today. Okay, so you'll notice that the caption over here says that these tubes are not in their correct proportions. The liberties were taken so that we could emphasize the nature of the connection between bronchioles and alveoli. So this terminal bronchial obviously is not that large, so don't be misled by the proportions. Portions are all wrong. Here's a drawing from your textbook. It is one of the classics of all time. I'm not going to start by this one. It's a classic because what the artist and the author has done is taken the conducting airways, the trachea and bronchi, which have cartilage in the wall, and drawn in bronchioles and the respiratory airways down below here, the respiratory begins with respiratory bronchioles, and then has made a little chart of what you will find along the airways beginning up above. And probably the two most important messages from this chart is that the epithelium does what? Gets thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner as you move down the airways, and it becomes simple squamous epithelium in the alveoli. It's cells, mucus-producing cells, do we want them down in the alveoli? Would you want to have mucus in your alveolus all the time? What do you want to have in there? Air. You want to have air in there. So certainly we don't want goblet cells to go all the way down into the respiratory part of the airway. So they stop. They stop up high. There may be a few of them in some of the columnar epithelium, but you're never going to find them in the boiling epithelium. Ciliated cells are found at a lower level, and so this particular spot between here and here is interesting, isn't it? Because the ciliated cells are found deeper down, the mucous cells stop much higher. Can you think of an advantage of that? What happens if the mucus dribbles down by gravity? The mucus kind of dribbles down by gravity, then you got ciliated cells to make sure that that mucus is removed from those inner regions. The tracheobronchial glands, you know, they're making mucus, and serum too, but a lot of mucus, they stop just about where the goblet cells stop. So you're not going to find too many glands in bronchioles. You're not going to find too many goblet cells in bronchioles. And so that level right there, level right here, is the region where the bronchioles begin. But there's not going to be any mucus gland or goblet cells, but there will be cilia. So that's what you would expect to see in the lab in the lungs. Hyaline carcinoid, you know, stopped at the bronchus level, not found down the bronchioles. Smooth muscle travels a long ways down, not quite as far as the last fibers. The most important part of this drawing, I think, is right here at the beginning, and then right here at the end. Be very, very clear that the epithelium is getting thinner, and elastic hard fibers are found everywhere. And that allows us to exhale, to breathe out. Okay, so what about these bronchioles? Well, they don't have any cartilage, and they're about 1 to 2 millimeters in diameter and less, and smaller. They're very tiny. There's no cartilage in their walls. It's smooth muscle. Why is there smooth muscle? Do you happen to see that when you're looking at the lung? What would the smooth muscle around the bronchial imply? What's the function? What do they do? Why are they there? Contract? And what contraction of a bronchial do? Do what? What do smooth muscle cells do in blood vessels? What's the end of result of contracting of arterioles and smooth muscle? It alters pressure and it reduces flow. How are you going to get flow through a smaller tube? And so these smooth muscles regulate airflow through bronchioles. And in asthma patients, these are super sensitive. And during an attack, they are contracting ferociously, and the patient's trying to get air through a tiny bronchial, and you hear, that same thing you heard yesterday. Yeah, the smooth muscle is super sensitive in patients that are having an attack, well, that have that. When you get down into the bronchioles, you might find columnar, you might find pseudostratified at first, and then columnar, all within the bronchioles. The smaller bronchioles would have cuboidal, and the larger bronchioles would have columnar or pseudostratified. Why do you think the epithelium looks like this? Because when the air leaves, the elastic properties of the bronchial cause it to retract and get smaller, and that throws the epithelium. helium into foam. The nice thing about that is that it allows you to recognize a bronchiole in the laboratory final exam by the convoluted fold kind of epithelium that we classically see in bronchiole. If this were in a living, breathing human being, you wouldn't see that. The epithelium would be nice and flat around the outside. It wouldn't be folded up like that. In bronchioles, we're going to see some interesting cells called the Clara cell, capital C, named after someone. And so let's look for Clara cells here. There's not a drawing like Mary Schenkel here, but a photograph taken through a microscope like I see some of you doing in class, photographing through the oculars. This is called a terminal bronchial. What might that mean? That's the last one. And what happens next? The respiratory airways begin. Right after the last bronchial, the respiratory airways begin. Of course, they lied to you, because there's one more tube after this called the respiratory bronchial. So, funky enough. It's not really the terminal bronchial. Well, it's the terminal bronchial with respect to the conducting airways. The last bronchial for the conduction of air, and the next bronchial, or the next piece of airway now, is called respiratory. And it can engage in that exchange. Smooth muscle. Epithelium is folded. There's a lamina propria in here. No goblet cells. And no tracheobronchial gland. No cartilage. This shows that along the airways, we have these concentrations of lymphoid follicles. And so here's a follicle. And of course, it's would be called then bronchus, associated lymphoid tissue. Mostly B cells, but there could be some straggling T cells around the vicinity too. Notice that the epithelium appears dark and is folded. See the fold? It appears dark. There's some smooth muscle in here. But as the bronchial is branching and branching and further branching, we see that this epithelium is not easy to see anymore. And of course, that makes sense because it's super thin now. It looks pretty thick here, but it's getting very, very thin. And finally, the air that has been coming in because the diaphragm contracted, the air is coming in and is now entering these little rooms called the air sac or alveolus, and in the wall. These rooms are tons of what? Capillaries, right? And the walls, like these walls here with plumbing in them. There's no plumbing, there's no plumbing. Lots of capillaries. And the Clara cells can be seen in bronchioles, especially the terminal bronchial, and they have secretory granules in them. They're ciliated cells, too, with the terminal bar here. They're ciliated cells, but the Clara cells kind of fold outward, reminiscent of those cells in the bladder. Remember those dome cells in transitional epithelium? But they're secretory, and they have a lot of Golgi apparatus and a lot of rough ER and a lot of secretory granules. And the search was on for years and years and years to find out what in the world are these cells secreting into the airways. And a couple of things have been found, but the one that you should focus your attention on right now, one of these substances right now is called surfactant. And the function of that we'll talk about here a little more as we go along. Surfactant is a substance you'll encounter in physiology as well. It's a substance that lines the alveolus and keeps that alveolus from collapsing, from totally emptying. And so as a result of that, the alveoli in our lungs have what's called a residual volume that you cannot exhale. And I can demonstrate that by trying to exhale here. air in my elbow. It's called the residual volume. It's about 1,200 cc's of air. So unless somebody came back when I was doing that and whacked me in the back, then I would have lost my wind, right? And I would maybe have lost some of the residual volume, but not all, even then. Well, so those spirochetes are secretory, and they secrete a substance that helps keep the airways open. Here's some more of them, showing the little granules here. No ciliated cells now. We're way down the terminal bronchial, and there are a lot of these gorgeous cells. They are gorgeous, but the picture right there for you. They're gorgeous cells, and here they are bulging into the lumen in a scanning electron microscope picture. They produce surfactant. Cells in the alveolus also produce surfactant, and that surfactant helps maintain the patentness, the openness of these alveoli so they don't collapse when you exhale. That's a subject in physiology. It involves intermolecular forces and Brownian movement, and it acts as a detergent, and it lowers the surface tension of water. And so water molecules don't have an attractive force to them as much anymore. So it's like Dawn detergent soap, and it contains lecithin, and if you want to know if your baby is ready to be born, you can take out some amniotic fluid and look for the products in surfactant to see if that baby will be born without respiratory distress syndrome. So surfactant is an important physiological and clinically important substance to think about. And we'll look at surfactant some more and see where it is. Okay, so the respiratory bronchioles are the next passageways. And as we said, they have the ability to engage in gas exchange. And so what we find in respiratory bronchioles are a few alveoli. So if we were to draw the terminal bronchial line by cuboidal epithelium. I'm not going to put the cuboidal epithelium all over, but lined by cuboidal epithelium. And then the cuboidal epithelium continues on as the terminal bronchial, as the terminal bronchial divides, and so there's cuboidal epithelium here. And along this airway, now there's a little bulge. And down here, bulge there. This is lined by simple squamous, because that's an alveolus. But this is lined by cuboidal epithelium. But this entire structure I'm drawing is called the respiratory bronchial. And it's a mixture of a straight tube plus some lateral dilation. Respiratory bronchial. And then that course that's going to divide. One more time. Division one more time. And now we end up with the tube that is loaded with alveoli. In this passageway, the air is coming down. Air is coming down through the respiratory bronchial. The respiratory bronchial, then through down here and down here. And the green arrow I just drew is called the alveolar duct, or it's called the hallway at Bastrian. university. It's a hallway. And off of that hallway are rooms. Just like in your old high school. Main hallway, and there's the chemistry lab, and over here is the English classroom. And so we have this hallway, and off this hallway are these air sacs. That'll be a lot. Which are actually out pocketing of an alveolar duct. The respiratory bronchial is also a hallway. And there's an occasional air sac off of that. So from here to here is the region where the alveolar duct is a hallway. With lots of potential for gas exchange. And so that these alveolar ducts and alveoli occupy the greatest volume of your lung. And that's why when you look at lung in lab, you see mostly alveoli. And you see an occasional bronchial. Now, don't forget that we've got to add, you know, the other alveolar duct over here too. And so, and of course we duplicate it over here, don't we? Same thing happens over here. Because each airway is described as branching dichotomously. What word? Dichotomous. What would di mean? Two. One becomes two. And so here's the terminal bronchial becoming two. Two respiratory bronchioles and so forth and so on. Well, that's the entire unit. This entire unit is surrounded by some delicate, loose connective tissue, a tiny, thin little separation between this unit and the next unit. And this unit is called the lobule of the lung. Terminal bronchial containing all kinds of clara cells. I could put some cuboidal epithelial cells and some bulging clara cells there too. A lot of clara cells, some cuboidal epithelial cells. And of course, when we get to pathology class, we'll talk about the emphysema patient that has emphysema described as centra lobular emphysema. If the name of the disease is central lobular emphysema, then tell me where the damage is. Which part of the lobule? The center. What's the center of the lobule? Respiratory bronchioles. Yeah.
Sorry, I was wondering on the slide before this if there was anything in the picture as well.
No. I don't know where I got this flower. They're lilies. No, I don't know if they are. They're flowers. I don't know one flower from the next. They're claricel flowers. So central lobular emphysema is emphysema involving damage to the central part of the lobule. Respiratory bronchioles are significantly damaged. When in pathology we come to another type of emphysema called pan-lobular emphysema. What do you think pan might mean? All of it. All of it being what? Terminal bronchial, respiratory bronchial, alveolar duct, alveolus. The entire lobule is shot. Which one is worse? Which emphysema is worse? Pan-lobular emphysema. It's going to kill the patient quickly. Good thing that's not caused by cigarette smoking. Central lobular popular is caused by cigarette smoking and other environmental pollutants. Tan lager is called by alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, so different situation. All right, so let's move on. Is there any simple cuboid mesothelium along the alveolar duct? In fact, there is, right at the opening. Cuboid mesothelium, right at the openings into the air sac. Cuboid mesothelium, a couple, three or four cells, right in the doorway of the alveolus. How is the simple squamous epithelium arranged? Well, it's arranged like a simple squamous epithelium. It lines the airways, and it's a very super thin cytoplasmic layer. What is the arrangement of alveoli along the alveolar ducts? Well, the arrangement is like classrooms off a hallway. The trouble is, this is a two-dimensional drawing. And so, are there any alveoli off the alveolar duct going back behind the whiteboard? Yeah, how about coming this way? Yes, sort of like a space station. You walk out of that tube in the space station, and there may be a room up in the ceiling and a room not. The point is that there are alveoli coming off the alveolar ducts in all different directions. Don't be misled by a two-dimensional.
Like a bunch of grapes, right?
Okay.
Like a bunch of grapes.
Yes, like a
bunch of grapes.
Good.
If the alveoli are, if their surface is made up of simple squamous epithelium,
uh-huh.
How are they secreting this effect?
Because along with that simple epithelium, let's draw an alveolus here. Along with that simple squamous epithelium, interspersed in there is a cuboidal cell down there. So the entire alveolus is not thin and flat. And this particular cell is called a type 2 alveolar cell, and it's got secretory granules and looks almost indistinguishable from a clara cell. You see where the surfactant goes? Treated out into here by the alveolus. Is there another handout? Okay. Where are the elastic fibers? Where are the capillaries? Capillaries are in these walls. Between the air sacs. And these walls are called inter, between, you name it for me, inter-alveolar septa. Between the alveolar septa, and that's where the elastic fibers are as well. So there's some elastic fibers in there. And there's some reticular fibers in there as well. So the interalveolar septa contain the capillaries and the necessary connective tissue, and even an occasional nerve fiber can be found in the interalveolar septa.
Could you repeat what a simple cuboidal epithelium
sound? In
the alveolus?
Or, yeah, some structure you do. Right, and so if you're... If you enter the alveolus and you're an oxygen molecule, you'll pass by some cuboidal epithelial cells here. And you may even have to seal it. You pass your air molecule, you pass in here, and you'll see the simple squamous type 1 alveolar cell first. Then you mosey on over here, and you can see the type 2 cell, and it's secreting surfactant. So if you look at a three-dimensional drawing of this, you can see that the alveoli can poke out of the walls in almost any direction. And you also notice that the alveoli seem to be concentrated, and I did a poor job of that. The alveoli are much more concentrated out at the end of the alveolar duct. It is not, because I don't know how to draw it. So on the very end there, whole cluster of alveoli, that's sometimes called, you see, the alveolar sac. I didn't draw it. The very end. When you walk out of some of these concourses at the airport, you're maybe not walking, you may be running, and there's gate number blah, 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 and there's gate number so-and-so. Come out of the end of the concourse, and you come to the end of the concourse, and there's this big atrium, isn't there? And there's a gate here, and a gate there, and a gate there, and all in this big circle. Well, that's an alveolar duct. Alveolar duct. You got all these gates that are opening into alveoli, and this is the end of the concourse. There's a big atrium there where the alveoli are actually concentrated. Notice from this beautiful, simple drawing that the capillaries in the interalveolar septa that I drew in two dimensions here are extremely extensive. Capillary beds are enormously concentrated around each alveolus, and I couldn't in any way represent that in a histological drawing. Intermingled with these capillaries, and artists draw them up here, so you can see they'd be up here too. And intermingled with these capillaries are these network of elastic fibers. So let's write that down. basement membrane fused in a minute. And of course, we've got in the tissue space these elastic fibers and particular fibers are in tissue space because that's where connective tissue belongs. We're going to look for a pore of code here in a second. Interesting little structure that helps to equilibrate air pressure. And this is that slide I promised you on the distribution of elastic fibers. How were we able to see these elastic fibers indicated by the arrow there? Stained, weren't they? They were stained specifically for elastic fibers. H&E would not show that. So these little black objects within the intraalveolar septa are the distribution of elastic fibers. Here's an electron microscopic picture in the intraalveolar septum here. And E is labeling elastin, elastic fiber. Notice the alveolar macrophages that you were asked to look for. They look like they're suspended in air. They don't bounce around like billiard balls when the air comes in. You can see them bouncing around. They're stuck on the surface, but they became detached by the processing and the cutting with a knife and so forth. So, that's the only way you can really recognize them is if they get detached and are found out in the airspace. If you can master this one, you know the lung very, very well. Let's put an asterisk on this drawing. Another classic drawing showing the intraalveolar septa and how the alveoli are arranged side by side. And so these alveoli here, 1, 2, 3, 4, label them here. 1, 2, 3, 4, label them over here. Squamous epithelium, the sheetrock, like this, is simple squamous epithelium. There it is right there. Let's see if we can find one here. Right here, right there, right there, right there, right there. What are those cells doing? The blue staining cells, what are they doing? Making surfactant. Right. Making surfactant. But the majority of the cells are type 1, meaning simple squamous. But the goital kind of cells, type 2.
So Clara cells are only up in the terminal bronchial, and these are just called
only, type 2. Only up in the bronchioles, right.
And these are just called type 2.
Right, they're not called Clara cells here because they have a little different anatomy, but they're essentially doing the same thing. And there's an alveolar macrophage attached to the surface here. And those alveolar macrophages can wander back in the septum. So here's a macrophage in the septum. And here's some connective tissue fibers, elastic fibers and reticular fibers. You can see the fibers, nature, little hair-like structures there. What we need to do now is look at a capillary. And there's one here, and so let's look at that capillary. Right there, in a little higher magnification. These capillaries in the intraalveolar septa fuse very tightly to the simple squamous cell. This doesn't show it here, but it does show it there. Here I can see some tissue space between the capillary and the simple squamous. That's probably not the way it should be. But over here, the artist drew this capillary and fused it with the simple squamous epithelium. And what's this barrier called right here where the capillary fuses to the simple squamous cell? alveolar septa from Ross's atlas. The capillaries here, it doesn't show the capillaries as nicely as you'd expect, and you have a hard time seeing the simple squamous cells here, don't you? Very difficult to see. In fact, it wasn't until 1962 where they actually demonstrated with the electron microscope that there were simple squamous cells lining the surface. For years and years and years, with the use of the light microscope, no one was sure that there were simple squamous cells. And actually, it was my graduate advisor who first discovered simple squamous cells lining the lung here with the electron microscope. Scanning electron microscope, if you cut the alveolar septa correctly, you can see the intensity of the capillaries, which is not very clear here. Some of them, and most of them are collapsed. But here in this preparation, where you artificially inflated the capillaries through the pulmonary artery, but now you can see the extreme intensity of the capillary bed within the interalveolar septa. A little higher magnification, you can even see a profile of a red blood cell through the wall there, because there's a capillary of the curve right there. Just imagine you being a little air molecule cooling down into that air sac there, kind of looking around, seeing what you see. There's a type 2 alveolar cell right there. Okay, let's draw the blood-air barrier. It's composed of type 1 alveolar cells. Type 2 don't engage in gas exchange because they're too thick. Can't get oxygen carbon dioxide across them. We're going to see that the type 2 cells are important because they begin to secrete surfactant. Now, in terms of clinical correlations, it's important to know at some point in time when type 2 cells appear in the fetus. Because if the baby's born before this time, then they're going to have breathing problems. If the baby's born before type 2 cells appear, then with the first breath of life passing down the birth canal, the first breath of life, the alveoli all inflate. They weren't inflated before because the baby can't breathe in the uterus. So all these alveoli pop open. You can hear them popping. If you listen carefully. Hear them popping open. And then the baby exhales. What happened? No surfactant. What's going to happen? All the alveoli collapse. So now it's the second breath of life. And then all the alveoli open. It takes a lot of effort to open those alveoli. You ever try to blow up a balloon that's empty, that's made up of thick rubber? It's hard to get it started, isn't it? But after you get a little air in it, it's hard to open these alveoli the first time. So the second breath, the third breath, the fourth breath, the fifth breath, they're all like the first breath. Terribly traumatic without the alveoli remaining open. And when do these type 2 cells appear? They're at its highest mitotic rate in the 24th week of pregnancy. 38 to 40 weeks generally, huh? 24 weeks. So if the baby's born before 24 weeks, there's a risk of hyaline membrane or respiratory distress syndrome. They have to be put on positive ventilation and incubated. Type 2 cells are clearly important, aren't they? When do they form in the human body? During fetal life, around the height of the production, around 24 weeks of gestation. What happens when they're missing? We just talked about it. When do we find too many type 2 cells? In viral pneumonias and some other diseases. We'll talk about that here. The endothelium of it. Now, what happened if there's too many type 2 cells? What do you think about that? Let's say the alveolus is covered with type 2 cells. How's the breathing doing? Breathing's doing fine. How's the respiration doing? Four. Breathing fine. In and out, in and out, in and out. How's the gas exchange? cratty. You can't get the gas through it, thick epithelium.
What about that baby? So now from the incubator on respiration, what's like the hope for that baby?
Oh, the hope is you can give the baby some drugs which stimulate and encourage the production of type 2 cells, and you just have to wait.
Right.
And when the type 2 cells appear, then everything's going to be hunky-dory.
They have artificial surfactant, too.
Yeah, they have artificial surfactant as well. But you can stimulate surfactant with a lot of things like cortisol. That's one reason why some people would prefer to have a baby born naturally through the birth canal as opposed to a cesarean section. Because when the baby passes down the birth canal, the baby has a traumatic birth and shoots out a bunch of cortisol from the adrenal gland, which stimulates type 2 cell production during the time of a vaginal birth. And it doesn't happen with a cesarean. So let's draw this down here. Let's draw this whole thing. And let's see where and what structures the gas molecules have to go across. Here's a red blood cell, and out here is the hair in the alveolus. And here's where the capillary, right here, is tightly attached to the type 1 alveolar epithelium. Type 1 cell. Type 2 cell would be down here. That'd be a big tube. That'd be a really big tube. And here is the type 1 simple squamous cell, very thin. And what do we find intervening between the oxygen molecules in the air and the plasma in the blood? Well, this oxygen has to pass through a thin layer of surfactant, dotted line. And it has to pass through a cytoplasm of a type 1 epithelial cell. And it has to pass through a single basement membrane. That's this thing here. Basement membrane. Basal lamina, basement membrane. And then the air passes through the endothelial cell, and now it can dissolve in plasma. There. So it's three main structures, two epithelial cells, the basement membrane, and then we can add a fourth, we can add that surfactant layer, which is no barrier. Not really a significant barrier. Let's look at the picture in Rasta, which is a little better because Rasta stands back a little farther and includes more of the picture. And what we see in Rasta's picture is an air sac, alveolus up here. And here's the capillary in the interalveolar septum. And notice that the capillary endothelium here has a basement membrane in red. And you see that the alveolar epithelium has a basement membrane, basal lamina, also in red. And look what happens. The basal lamina of the alveolus and the basal lamina of the endothelial cells fuse. And so that includes the tissue space right here. There's no tissue space now. There is over here in the interalveolar septum where the elastic fibers are and everything. But right where the capillary touches the alveolus, the tissue space gets squeezed out of existence. We don't want a fibroblast in there. We don't want elastic fibers in there because we want the thinnest possible transport site for gas. And that results in a single fused basal lamina where oxygen and carbon dioxide can pass through very nicely. I don't know why Ross drew that type 2 cell in there because that just interferes, doesn't it? That's not strategically placed. You want that out of the way up here someplace else. Notice that macrophages can go in and out of the alveolus, into the alveolus, and then back out again. Here's a type 2 cell. It's got all these secretory granules. We're going to finish this up now, and then we'll start the digestive tract beginning in the mouth in the second hour. What defense mechanisms are found along the airway? Well, why have defense mechanisms that are extremely extensive, I guess is the word, along our respiratory airway? Do you think we have a good reason for that? Yeah, because air contains stuff that we might not want. Bacteria suspended in air. Emissions from the tailpipe of a metro bus. I'm still jogging in downtown Seattle behind that metro bus. Ah, that air's pure. Yeah. And if you think about how much of your body makes contact with the outside world, what part of your body makes the greatest contact with the outside world? Let me rephrase that. What part of your body has the greatest surface area in contact with the outside world? Alveoli in the lung. You took all the epithelium of the alveoli in the lung and laid it out flat, it'd be half of a tennis court. If I took the skin off of me and laid it on the floor, would that be half of a tennis court? Not hardly. The epithelium in your lungs makes the greatest contact with the outside world of any part of your body. So we've got the most sophisticated defense mechanisms available, and let's go through them. Beginning with our nose hairs. Should be properly manicured. Thought about that. Pull them out, Pickles. Don't like them. Pull them out. Yank. Yank. Or scissors. You want your scissors. Or you can comb them. Anyway, we want these because they trap airborne particles that are very, very large, 5 microns and above. 5 micron diameter particles. Now, obviously, they're not going to trap a boulder because you can't suspend a boulder in air. It's only those particles that are suspended in air that are trapped by the nose hairs, 5 microns or so. And then we have antibody, IgA, along the airways in considerable amounts, just like along the gut wall. And then we have this famous mucociliary escalator, as physicians refer to it, as a pathologist refers to it, as an environmental toxicologist might refer to it. And what is that mucociliary escalator histologically? Pseudo stratified ciliated columnar with goblet cells. Mucus ciliary. Why is it called an escalator? Because the direction of the ciliary beat is upwards and out of the lungs. Everything's moving up against the force of gravity. So the mucus traps the particles, and in the pseudo stratified epithelium, the particle size is anywhere between 2 to 5 microns or micrometers in diameter particles. And so that could be clusters of bacteria. It could be particles coming from cigarette smoke or from the tailpipe of a carbon-burning monster car. And so pseudostratified epithelium, goblet cells, tracheal bronchial glands, ciliated cells, all the histology that you've been studying, either in lab or in your notes or here, all that histology of the most magnificent epithelium of our body contains all these things comprising the mucociliary escalator.
If you choke on something while you're eating and it gets into your airway, will you always cough?
No, it will. You will, as long as you have a normal epithelium, you will cough until that thing comes up. The only reason that you wouldn't is if some damage were to occur in the epithelium, or damage would occur to a nerve reflex. It could be a spinal cord lesion would prevent that from happening. And in gross anatomy, you'll find out that if you're at a party, a dinner party somewhere, and you're eating something and telling a joke and laughing all at the same time, and that that Big Mac piece of hamburger party in the so that piece of Big Mac goes down your trachea, and where's it going to end? If you find out in gross anatomy, it ends in the middle lobe bronchus of the right lung. Now you got to figure out why that is anatomically, and I'm not going to spoil it for you. So alveolar macrophages are also found there, and they're going to phagocytose particles in suspended in air that are 1 micron up to 2 microns in diameter. So the message here is that the smaller the particle is in the air, the deeper it goes in the lung. The larger particles caught by your nose hairs, and the smaller particles, by the way, 1 micron is the average diameter of a bacterium. And 1 micron is the diameter of an asbestos fiber, or asbestos snorting. And these alveolar macrophages then will phagocytose that particle and will go into the tissue space, find a lymphatic vessel, and go off to the nearest lymph node. Go to a lymph node. It's going to leave the alveolus, go into the interalveolar septa, find a lymph node, find a lymphatic. There was a lymphatic there too, by the way. And then head off to the lymph node. Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Why are we mentioning it now? Why the organism that causes tuberculosis? Because it is an intracellular bacteria. It does poorly outside of cell. Well, it can live outside of cell. Give somebody with tuberculosis and they spit on a wall. Those organisms can hang around that wall for several months. Just in the sputum on the wall. But they prefer to live in alveolar macrophages. That's their niche. And they love it because a macrophage can't kill them. It just restrains them, is all. And more about that in pathology class. But the point being here is that alveolar macrophages are the homes, the natural homes of mycobacteria. There they are, right here, and they're kind of artificially separated from the wall here. And they may have a lot of little particles in them, might be some carbon particles. So if a person's been smelling or breathing asbestos, then they may have some asbestos fibers. They also call dust cells. Let's come back in 10 minutes and start looking at this. Participating in part of this by working and cooperating with teeth, but what most people consider to be digestion is chemical action, breaking down protein to amino acids, breaking down carbohydrates to glucose, etc. And then once the molecules are small enough, like amino acids or glucose or fatty acids, then we can absorb these small molecules into the bloodstream. And this absorption has to go across an epithelium that you will be focusing your attention on as you go from esophagus to large intestine. If you examine the epithelium, think about or ask yourself, where in this tract does most of our absorption occur? Do amino acids and glucose enter the bloodstream at the level of the esophagus? No, not much. How about stomach? No. Whereabouts then? Small intestine, right? Small intestine. Colon absorbs water, make feces, so there's a lot of water absorption in the colon. Excretion then would be the elimination of the non-absorbable stuff. And we talk about excretion of waste material that is non-absorbable. We also talk about the digestive tract excreting bilirubin. Where was that from? Made the spleen, wasn't it? Made the spleen from red blood cells. So we can excrete things. The digestive tract is the main route that human beings excrete cholesterol. Get excess cholesterol, we want to excrete it in the feces. It comes down with bile, and it's excreted with bilirubin that way. All right, let's look briefly at the histology of the human lip. And there's a picture in Ross, and that's all there is a picture. There's not much of a discussion on it, and we're not going to have much of a discussion here either. But I do want to emphasize the fact that the skin of our face has these two layers with stratified squamous keratinized and dense irregular connective tissue, as the dermis and dermis. And that skin of your face is a component of the outside surface of your lip, whether it's upper lip or lower lip. And then as the epithelium crosses over into your mouth, a dramatic change occurs. The dermis becomes lamina propria, and the epidermis becomes stratified squamous non-keratinized epithelium. And this area now is not called skin anymore. It's called mucosa, but it has these two layers. It has an epithelium. I would lose half a point on the exam, wouldn't I? Non-keratinized. And actually, you'll find in neural cavity there is some partial keratinization in certain strategic areas, like on the surface of the tongue. Excellent. Partially keratinized. That's called para-keratin. You'll read about that in the lab. In your lab, it happens. We also have glands on the inside of our lip. Inside of our lip might be called buccal surface, or inside as opposed to outside. We have some glands. I know that because it's moist in here. It's wet, slimy. And sometimes a biopsy is taken of the labial gland, of the labial glands of the oral cavity, to diagnose Sjogren's disease. Don't write that down, but it's a way of diagnosing a certain kind of disease by taking a small biopsy there. Is the basal lamina continuous with that of the epidermis? Well, this has got a basal lamina. This has got a basal lamina, and absolutely, they are continuous layer from inside the lip to outside the lip. Here's the stratified squamous of the mucosa, and here's the stratified squamous of the skin. And I knew that right. side. So this is stratified sphagnum keratized, and there's some sweat glands there. But as you cross over the vermilion border, where some people put lipstick right there, over the vermilion border, then we end up encountering the mucosa, where stratified sphagnum is non-keratized, and the connective tissue now becomes loose connective tissue, a realer connective tissue, and the name is lamina propria, where you'll find a whole bunch of labial glands to make it nice and moist inside your lip for you. The reason why the lip is naturally kind of pinkish up here, this is all this, partly put lipstick on it. The vermilion border there, the reason it's partially pink anyway is because we have capillaries close to the surface underneath in the connective tissue, underneath in the dermis and stuff. A lot of capillaries there. And here is skeletal muscle. And you haven't studied this one in gross anatomy yet, but you'll be dissecting it out in a cadaver. You'll be looking for that muscle in the cadaver. If you work on the lips, you'll take the skin off, and you'll dig down, and you'll find a skeletal muscle going all the way around. If you've looked at diagrams already, it goes all the way around the mouth, and it's called the going around the mouth muscle. Or it's called orbicularis oris muscle, meaning going around the oris muscle. You have one around the eye, too, and it's called going around the eye muscle. Orbicularis oculi muscle. There it is there. Oh, a tongue. Well, we see a little partial characterization of the stratified space up in the tongue. And the tongue has, if you open up your mouth and look in the mirror, the tongue, you stick your tongue way out, the tongue has a little depression, a groove, in the posterior one-third of the tongue that's called the sulcus terminalis. And just in front of that will be some projections that you saw in lab that are called the circumvallate or just vallate papillae. Singular papilla. And these are these little devil's tower, these little devil's tower shaped buttes that are found right next to the sulcus terminalis, the posterior part of the tongue. And of course, you've already looked at skeletal muscle in the tongue because it seems to go in all different directions, doesn't it? So you can see cross sections and longitudinal sections all in the same slot. I'll show you this in a drawing here in a minute. There are some glands buried in the tongue, and we call them von Ebner's glands in laboratory this last week. There are four major projections within the epithelium of the tongue. The tongue has got pointy stuff on it, and these pointy things are called papillae. There are four major types. The sharp, pointy ones are called filiform papillae, and they're pretty pointy, And you can appreciate them if a cat licks you in the face, because you can feel those filiform papillae on the cat go abrasing across your face or your hand. They feel pretty sharp. Well, we don't have quite that sharpness, but that's the same papilla, filiform papilla. And then we got a not quite so pointy one that's kind of blobby looking, and it's called fungiform. Fungiform papilla have taste buds. Filiform papilla do not have any taste buds. Circumvallate papilla are the big ones in the back of your tongue next to this depression back there. And like rabbits, we have some foliate papilla with taste buds too that in the human run along the outer edge of the tongue. Not on top, not on bottom, but right along the edge. Especially the sides, not so much the front, but the side. And they have taste buds. So taste buds are found on three out of the four projections. And there we are. Here's that sulcus terminalis back here. It doesn't label it, so right at the back end of that, it's a little, if you can stick your tongue out far enough, you can see a little depression, a little dimple, like a Kirk Douglas dimple on the chin, you know, that sort of thing. A little dimple back there. That's called the foramen. That's a stupid name, isn't it? Because what does foramen mean? There's no hole there. There was. There was a long time ago when you were a fetus. There was a hole there because that's where your thyroid gland was born. Right there at the foramen cecum, and then it grew down your neck. Take up residence where your thyroid gland normally is found in the neck. And so as a consequence of that, some people have thyroid tissue anywhere from the base of their tongue all the way down to their neck. And little pieces that can be functional in the thyroid gland. There's also a chance of cysts forming in the neck. Cystic structures that are residual from this birth of the thyroid gland and its migration from that little dimple there back to your tongue. There's a fully along the lateral edge. Fungiform, you can almost see them. They sometimes appear pretty reddish. They're kind of big and bumpy. Not quite as big as the valley of the past year, though. More tongue stuff. There's a valley papilla. It's huge. Here's a fungiform. It's not quite as big. There's a valley papilla. Notice that the valley papilla has a deep groove around the central rejection. There's that deep groove. Well, that deep groove reminds me of a moat. There's a castle growing on the butte. It's this moat full of alligators, which you can see going down here. Von Ebner's gland jumped into that moat around the circumvallation. So that's a deep groove right there. Another picture of the same thing. Here's the circumvallation patella. There's a fungiform patella. Filiform are not illustrated very well, but they're here. But they look like Douglas fir trees. Filiform. They look like pointed Douglas fir trees as you're going across the mountain range in a train and looking down in the valley and seeing all those pointy fir trees sticking up in the air. And they are fairly sharp. And they can help move food back as we're eating. Notice the lamina propria is the epithelium, is the connective tissue beneath the epithelium, everywhere in the oral cavity, everywhere along the digestive tract, and also along the respiratory tract. Here's the filiform papilla, sharp, pointy object. The pulley papilla you're not going to look at in lab, you'll see them, so let's ignore that. Fungiform papillae are kind of dome shaped, nowhere near as big, however, as the circumvallate papilla. And this is the main one we asked you to look at in lab because it's easier to find and you get a chance to see some taste buds for the first or second time down deep in this moat. The circumvallate papilla doesn't appreciate taste up here in the surface. The food particles have to get down into the moat for the circumvallate papilla to appreciate the taste of any kind. Gary. The foramen cecum is right here, and the circumvallate papilla are in front of it in a V-shaped row. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in a row there.
Dr. Ferguson,
yeah.
How do taste buds work?
Taste buds have a nerve ending that sticks into the base of the taste bud, and these special cells react by receptors that we'll probably talk about in neuroscience react by chemical receptors on the surface of the cell that activates an act potential in the nerve ending. But the important thing is that there's a nerve ending at the base of the taste bud. That nerve ending doesn't go out and directly taste food. It just surrounds the bottom of the taste bud, and then the cells of the taste bud respond to the chemicals and then cause act potentials when an appropriate flavor comes by, I guess you might say.
Is that the function of the
Uvula. Oh, yeah, I can cut it out. I don't like that thing. Yeah, I don't know. It's like the allopaths say. All these things don't have any function. I don't know. Maybe it helps in resonating voice.
Does anyone know?
What's that? Well, the thing is extremely flexible, and it's part of the soft palate here. So it's not going to be any major obstacle because it can go straight out like that. And I don't think it's much of an obstacle.
Well, I think it hurts me an obstacle, but if you're swallowing something so big that it's hitting the uvula, then that would cause a gag reflex to be
uncomfortable. That's right. That's good. Yes, there's plenty of nerve endings. There's plenty of nerve endings here that are the same nerve endings that are back here. So if these are stimulated sufficiently enough, that certainly would contribute to a gag reflex. Thank you. That's good. There's plenty of nerve endings there. So later on when we talk about the involuntary phase of swallowing, we'll bring that up again.
Where is the sulcus terminalis?
Right here. There you go. Sulcus terminalis is a little depression right along here. A little groove. Can't see it. I didn't label it. A little groove. A little V-shaped victory sign. V-shaped. And at the tip of the V is a dimple right at the tip of that V. There's a higher bag view of circumvallate papilla. The taste buds now look like goblet cells, but do not confuse these for goblet cells. They have multiple cells within that structure of the taste bud, and so these are bigger than goblet cells. But they might be confused on the final exam for a goblet cell. There are no goblet cells, by the way, in stratified squamous epithelium. So that's another reason to rule them out. Okay, so this taste bud optional. In fact, we're not going to have anything on the exam because we're running out of time. But taste buds have all these particular structures, plus there are some nerve endings down at the base, and those nerve endings are connected to cranial nerve 7 in the anterior two-thirds of the tongue. Those nerve fibers here in a taste bud are connected to the glossopharyngeal nerve, the posterior one-third of the tongue, and these nerve endings for the taste bud back in the epiglottis are connected to the vagus nerve. So if you have a patient that loses taste on the anterior two-thirds of the tongue, they have something wrong with the facial cranial nerve 7. More of that, obviously, much more of that in gross anatomy. There's a drawing of taste bud. There's a nerve ending with either facial nerve, glossopharyngeal, or vagus. And these cells up here are responding to the chemicals that are passing by. This is called a taste cell. Some of these are supporting cells which aren't involved in appreciating taste. Two. We looked at this in lab. We went through it in lab, and the regions are crown, neck, and root. So you should probably look for that in a drawing, or go back into the lab and review that microscopic slide. The crown is where we will find enamel and dentin. The root is where we find primarily dentin. And the neck is the separation between the two. If you've ever been to the dentist and they have drilled out the center of your tooth, it's called doing a root canal. And what they removed is your pulp cavity, the loose connective tissue in the center of a root of the tooth. So we're going to look at all these things here. The bone of the mandible back here. The bone of the mandible and maxilla have holes in them for the tooth, and we call these textbook refers to this as alveolar bone because it looks a little bit spongy-like. And alveolar kind of is a word for spongy. It's not the typical spongy bone, however, that you find in an epiphysis of a long bone. The only reason I'm putting it up here is not to confuse you, but to realize that whenever they talk about tooth teeth, they talk about teeth being embedded in the alveolar bone, which is the bone of the tooth socket, the mandible and maxilla. And the tooth doesn't attach directly to the alveolar bone. The tooth is a little distance away, so the tooth is partially movable. You can't appreciate that movement very much, but it certainly is not directly attached to the surface of the bone. And so the membrane separates the tooth, and we all are familiar with the gingiva of gums. But how many of us remember to run that dental floss down the gingival sulcus where the dental floss goes? Well, let's find all these here. There's the gingival flap, and the sulcus is the groove where the dental floss goes down to the back of the tooth, and not so easy to do it, the front of the tooth, isn't it? And on the sides, the gingival sulcus really is only found on the front and back of the tooth and not on the sides, because there's no gingiva between the teeth. There's only bone. So the crown is what you see in the mirror, composed of enamel on the outside and dentin. You can see. You hope you have some enamel anyway, because the dentin is not very resistant to decay. While enamel is very resistant to decay. And the root of the tooth is buried and you can't see it. Unless you have periodontal disease, then when you smile, the roots of your teeth show to the person you're smiling at. If you don't want that, you don't want periodontal disease. Normally, the root is buried deep down in the alveolar bone and you can't see it. The neck is the midregion, separating the crown that you can see and the root that you can't see. The neck is the halfway mark there. And of course, the pulp cavity runs to the center, got a little opening down here. Nerves, capillaries, arterial, venule, loose connective tissue, pulp cavity. Odontoblasts are the cells that make the dentin. Ameloblasts make enamel, and they're not here anymore. Because the ameloblasts are on the outside surface of the enamel. So if we were to draw a crown of a tooth here and draw the enamel something like this, ameloblasts, kind of cuboidal epithelial-looking cells, different connective tissue cells, are found at one time on the outside surface of the enamel. And the baby can be born that way. Well, no, not really, because the tooth has to erupt first. But after the tooth erupts, during that eruption process, when the baby's tooth appears, the decidual tooth appears, there may be some ameloblasts left on that enamel. But as soon as the baby starts eating food, firm food, all those cells are washed away by the cracker or the squash or whatever the baby eating milk doesn't wash away. You lick. So these ameloblasts are gone forever is the point. We have no more ameloblasts. We cannot regenerate our enamel because the cells are gone a long time ago. But the odontoblasts still remain. And so dentin can be maintained in a viable way for quite a long time. It's hard to repair, though, if dental caries gets into it. But there they are, the odontoblasts lining the pulp cavity. Ameloblasts are on the outside surface.
Is there a time period that you would want to abstain from solid food for the child then so that the enamel has a
The enamel is fully developed at the time of eruption. When the baby is born, the tooth bud isn't seen because it's below the surface and it's still developing. We have one slide in your collection that shows these teeth before they've erupted, and it's a bone slide. You have to look at the developing face of the fetus. Yes? Ameloblasts, well, yeah. When the deciduous teeth erupt, then the permanent teeth begin to form, and they're below the surface, so they're going to erupt just like a decidual tooth, and when they erupt, the ameloblasts are gone, as they've erupted from the skin or the mucosa.
Can you write that word on the board?
Ameloblasts? Sure. Coming up in your outline. A-M-E-L-O, black. A-M-E-L-O, black.
Why do you have two sets of teeth?
Why do we have what?
Kind of
why do we have baby teeth that are replaced by permanent teeth? I don't have a clue. Yeah, the question would be, why aren't we born with 32 teeth? And part of the reason would be that our mouth is smaller. But the dentin does increase in size because the odontoblasts are present. So theoretically, if we were born with small teeth, they could get bigger anyway to accommodate a larger mouth. So I'm still not certain why it happens that particular way.
When you get a cavity, is that affecting the dentin?
The enamel doesn't develop cavities, the dentin does. And so generally the enamel has been eroded away somehow or another, and the drilling is done in the dentin, not the enamel. Sometimes the enamel will be removed during the process, but generally the caries occurs when the enamel has cracked or has disappeared from a site that allows the bacteria to get in to the dentin. And here's the neck of the tooth shown right in the green arrow here, and the crown shows enamel, and the crown will have dentin within the interior of it, and the periodontal ligament runs along the root of the tooth and prevents the root of the tooth from growing into the bone. So you can see the periodontal ligament here. Collagen fibers, look at the arrangement of the collagen fibers. They run in a direction straight across the gap between the alveolar bone and the tooth surface. The collagen fibers are attaching into the bone, and they're attaching into a layer called the cementum on the outside surface of the tooth. Cementum is a substance that the periodontal ligament collagen fibers insert. And if you press down from the top, you press down on the top of the tooth, and you see the anatomy, the histology of the tooth, I'm sure you can appreciate the fact that that tooth can be allowed to be pressed into a socket for a very tiny way. So the tooth could go down, 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 a little way. That probably prevents the enamel from being crushed during eating by the 2,000 foot-pounds of pressure that we can exert on our teeth when we're chewing. So the teeth have an ability to dip down, or in the case up here, go up into the socket because of the periodontal ligament. Here's the gingival sulcus. There's where the dental floss should go. These histological specimens don't show the enamel So this space wouldn't be that big. It's showing it's called enamel space because enamel would have been in here. But we can't cut teeth that have enamel. It's too hard to cut. Here's the gum. Now you might say gum here. This is gingiva. That's the ginger. You salt this along with the where the enamel's within. So the main tissues of the tooth are dentin, made by odontoblasts, and that's fairly soft compared to the enamel, which is extremely hard, and that's made by ameloblasts, which are long gone in you and I now. The other substance is cementum, which of course is found between, on the surface of the tooth, right here, cementum, between the tooth and the periodontal membrane. And the cells that make that, oh, is dentin spelled with an E or not an E? I think this is gum. It's gum. Periodontal ligament is searching to the cementum, and the pulp cavity is found in the center. We don't have time to talk about the chain from deciduous to permanent teeth, but if you're a dental hygienist or have been working with the dentist in the past, you'll have numbers assigned to all the permanent teeth. Tooth number 1, tooth number 16, tooth number 22, and so forth. Here's dentin, here's pulp cavity, and here's the odontoblast layer. Where are we? We are right in here, looking at the odontoblast and the pulp cavity, right in the center of the root of the tooth. And you can see that the odontoblasts kind of line up in rows, and they have a long process. They have a long cytoplasmic process that goes all the way through. There it is there. All the way through the dentin. Meaning that the odontoblast has a process that passes through a canal and runs the entire thickness of the dentin on that side. That reminds me of a canaliculus. Or an osteocyte. And the process is called the odontoblastic process. A living portion of the cell. Another picture, here's the pulp cavity, loose connective tissue, there's the odontoblast layer, and here's the early dentin being made, the new dentin being made called pre-dentin. If this were bone, that would have been called osteoid. That's new bone. But this is a new dentin. It's called pre-dentin. There's a fully formed dentin over here. You can see the odontoblast process running through a tubule. I love this section. Let's go back quickly, and then we'll end it right here. We're going to look at a cross-section of the tooth now. Not the classic picture that you see in the dental office, but a cross-section of the root of the tooth. So we're going to slice it right across here now, and then we're going to look down at it. And this is a beautiful picture. The alveolar bone is around the outside of the tooth. The pulp cavity is in the inside, and so we'll find odontoblasts right along there. This is a cross-section through the root of the tooth. Now, the dentin, We're well below the enamel now, so this is all dentin. You can see the radiating processes of the odontoblasts. Cementum is found on the outside root surface of the root of the tooth. There it is there, that darker colored stuff. That dark colored cementum. Super glue, maybe, if you want, super glue. And then the collagen fiber, the periodontal ligament, radiate between the cementum and the bone. And so this is a tooth socket with a tooth in the socket and a cross-section of the tooth. Very much better in my mind to look at that than the classic picture that you see in the dental office, which is this one here, because that doesn't give me much of an impression about the periodontal ligaments. What dentist works in this area of the periodontal ligament? Periodontist. Right. Okay, well, that's a shock. And the next time we'll finish up with this. We don't have much left to do, and then we're going to do esophagus to colon. next time we meet.